There are many Jews today, religious and less traditional, men and women, in Israel and the diaspora, affluent and of humble means, who feel that somehow something does not quite add up in their spiritual lives. Tracing the roots of those emotions are difficult and complicated because such feelings by nature are often hard to put into words. They're often inchoate. But in the privacy of thought, I suspect for many people, a stark reality begins to emerge, which is that Judaism, which is expected to be nurturing and sustaining, does not leave us with the sensation of being filled up, of being inspired. Now, in the Orthodox world, one hears constant talk about the fallout from this loss of connection. And it seems to me a culture of complaint has arisen, almost but not quite replacing a community of faith. And the targets are familiar. What is called the slide to the right, with too much emphasis on externals and chumrot, or da Torah, which in some circles is interpreted as privileging authority over individual conscience and rational thought, or materialism run amok, where frum people exhibit gaudy displays of excess and seem utterly oblivious to the bad taste that this leaves for others who cannot possibly share in this bounty, or uninspired Torah education with too much dry information and not enough fostering of midot and kavanah, or superficial piety as opposed to the inner life, or too much seduction at the hands of Western culture and not enough dedication to mitzvah observance, or a diluted commitment to Limud HaTorah, or too much distraction and too little passion. And the list of the alleged culprits who are responsible for this ensues. Gedolim are to blame, rabbis are to blame, balabatim are to blame, shuls are to blame, schools are to blame, parents are to blame, TV is to blame, the internet is to blame, feminism is to blame, fundamentalism is to blame, halakha is to blame, and of course, God is to blame. And Israelis will have their own spin on this matter, and non-Orthodox Jews will weigh in as well, and everyone has their own private version of these laments. And they do point to real problems, but I would like to suggest that rather than being the cause of our present malaise, they are in fact symptoms of a much larger dilemma, and that the solutions to this quandary may require actually a fundamental rethinking of how we carry out Torah. Because it is a crisis that goes back to the creation of human beings and even further back than that, and it is an existential rip in the fabric of life, and it won't admit of an easy mending. So to describe this scene a little further, we need to take a step back, or maybe sideways, and look at our own landscape. The social historians like to say that everyone is situated in a given place and a given time and a given historical context, and when you look at where we are situated, certain inescapable facts begin to loom very large. And though those elements are obvious, we perhaps do not always realize how profound the impact is on our spiritual lives, in big and small ways. And I'd like to discuss two particular items off the top that factor into any Jewish quest for religious meaning today. The first context, which I've spoken about often, must be that of modernity. We are so immersed in the modern world and have unwittingly absorbed so many of its presuppositions, from the autonomy of choice to the diversity of truth, that we often do not stand back and think about what effect this has on our ability to live a sacred life. In 1918, the sociologist Max Weber, in an essay entitled Science as a Vocation, writes the sentence that, for me anyway, becomes the defining credo of our age. Quote, "The fate of our times is characterized by rationalization and intellectualization, and above all, by the disenchantment of the world." Weber defines disenchantment as the knowledge or belief that there are no mysterious, incalculable forces that come into play, but rather that one can, in principle, master all things by calculation. What's an enchanted world? An enchanted world was one where there was a transcendent reality of beings and forces that existed outside of material substance. And that for people in, say, 1500 was as present to them as computers and cars are for us. It was interesting, actually, to listen to when Rabbi Skobach, if those of you who were here earlier, told the story about the woman who had her problem with the rat and ultimately tried to think of a solution that perhaps this rat is a Gilgul of some previous incarnation. And what I found fascinating about that story, and to be honest with you, I'll give you my reaction, was that there's a sort of internal groan I go through, like, who are you kidding? Right? Rats aren't Gilgulim. And right there is the disenchantment of the world that Weber pointed to. There is this ostensible, I wouldn't call it a charade, but there is this ostensible thing that we do called religion, but somewhere he caught at a kind of deep internal attitude that springs out. You're not even in control of it at that moment. That springs out and shows you what you really think about an enchanted world. That skepticism, that sense of, yes, I'm religious, but that but, dot, 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 is the but of modernity. You can put on your tefillin, but you can go to shul, but you can keep kosher, but you can keep Shabbat, but. And what comes after that ellipses is disenchantment. So when Weber terms the modern condition one of disenchantment, that doesn't simply mean that many people don't believe in God or an organized religion, or that we live in a secular age, to borrow some of those well-worn phrases by now. Rather, the language of disenchantment pervades far and deep, and it's something that nearly everyone expresses, consciously or unwittingly, regardless of your religious affiliation, regardless of the faith that you profess. Check out how we regularly sort of reproach each other for magical thinking or indulging in myth, or giving way to fantasy. We say that person X isn't living in our century, right? When we want to disparage a mindset that we think is yesterday. We say that person Y is out of touch with the world. We say that person Z has a mindset from the Middle Ages and so forth. The philosopher Charles Taylor, in a very telling phrase, argues that what contemporary people have created is a buffered self. Not open and porous and vulnerable to the world of the spirits and higher powers, but bounded up and guarded against such foolish notions as demons and fairies. Even in an ostensibly religious context, we're buffered against the idea that God is really involved in our lives and plays a direct role in nature and society, not to mention whether I'm going to get a promotion of work, or whether my grandmother will recover from her surgery, and whether God has anything to do with these matters. We still do the actions that bespeak an observant lifestyle, but somewhere deep inside, for many Jews, that taken-for-granted feeling that God is utterly in charge of life, my life, as well as the life of kings and queens, that idea has given way to a more prudent assessment of what, so to speak, is God's domain and what is mine. It's interesting to trace two very well-known reactions to disenchantment for the disorienting effect of the pull away from traditional religion, traditional understandings of the cosmos, has led in our time to two distinctly opposite trends, but they're both dealing with the same thing. And you can see them quite clearly in Judaism as well. You have, on the one hand, the lure towards fundamentalism, a promise of certainty, and the idea that somehow we can still return to a kind of faith-soaked age if we dress and speak a certain way, and above all, if we block out the discourse of complexity, of subtlety, of nuance, and of diversity, I'm actually quite sympathetic to this strategy, even as I do not share it nor really agree with it. And even as I think it may badly underestimate the ultimate power of modernity, but I do understand it. And there's also the opposite tendency in evidence, and I see this actually increasingly in the last 15 years, which is that of the personal spiritual quest, completely shorn from religion. Still yearning for the dimensions that religion used to fill, but people want to fill it in a different way now, a kind of quasi-New Age brand of creating a paradise within. I don't say that disparagingly. It's also a strategy I understand. Although sometimes I find it a little bit too anchored in individualism, a little bit tending towards narcissism, but I do understand it. The second factor about where we are situated that bears down on faith today is quite clearly the Holocaust. And it is ironic, actually, that although we spend vast amounts of time and energy mourning, commemorating, talking, writing, teaching about the Shoah, we sometimes still lose track of the enormous gravitational pull it exerts on our efforts to live Jewishly. If you examine, for instance, the thought of Rav Yehuda Amital, who along with Rav Lichtenstein was the longtime Rosh HaYeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, one is struck by his unflinching honesty regarding the catastrophic spiritual aftermath of the Shoah. Dr. Diamond, at the end of his talk, indicated that the Shoah really eclipsed all previous Jewish suffering, and the truth is Rav Amital agrees. He writes, if a person does not feel that Eicha or Keynote pale beside the Holocaust, then he is belittling the Holocaust. The trauma of the Shoah has a direct effect on our ability to feel confident as Jews. Rav Amital writes, in the wake of the severance in the fundamental Jewish continuity of the nation as the result of the Holocaust, 6 million dead, a culture destroyed, the new generation lacks the rootedness that nourished their forefathers, and for them, everything now has to be re-examined with a wretched sense of insecurity. And note the connection he now makes. Anything that is not discussed explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch is difficult to integrate properly into one's inner world, and especially one's Torah world. Right? The Holocaust breeds a sense of loss, which breeds a sense of insecurity, which breeds a sense of rigidity. I've got to look it up in the book, and that becomes my religion. And anything outside of that box, I'm incapable of synthesizing. A kind of paralysis, in fact, with halakha exerting an iron grip over any other kind of sensibility. What worries Rav Amital is that this emphasis on halakha may come at the cost of neglecting morality. He writes, I believe that this excessive emphasis on halakha has entailed a somewhat undesirable price. The impression has been created that there is nothing in Torah other than that which exists in halakha, and that in addressing any new problem that arises in modern society, answers should be sought solely in the works of the halakha. Many of the fundamental values of the Torah that are based on general mitzvot, like you shall be holy, kedoshin tiyu, right? You shall do what is right and good in God's eyes, tov v'yashar be'inav. But these things have no explicit instructional formulation. It's not one act that you can point to. Are not only underrated, writes Rav Amital, but have lost some of their validity in the eyes of a public that sees itself as obligated to halakha. He concludes, we know that halakha is only an opening, right? We get that from the etymology of the word. It's just the way. A gateway through which the Holy One transmits a certain message to us, while a large portion of the laws pertaining to human behavior are intended for a person to fulfill out of inner awareness. How do you teach that awareness? We teach laws. How do you teach awareness? In the laws of character traits, no code, such as Shulchan Aruch, is of any use, he writes. If the heart has not been mended, no codified law will help you. The purpose of the Torah is that you perform and fulfill the Torah as the Avot fulfilled it out of inner awareness. So here we are, situated in 2008, buffered against real enchantment, battered by the awesome shadow of the death camps that now stretches over 60 years. And we are attempting to cobble together a life of authenticity and Jewish mindfulness. Not an easy task by any measure. And in their own way, this was, of course, the task facing the generation of the Churban HaBayit, who also needed to figure out how to reconstruct a meaningful Jewish life. And their questions are really ours as well, because these are questions that never stop for all of our lives, for all of Jewish history. Where does God fit into this world, and where do I fit? To put it a different way, how can there be space both for God and for me? What happens when God feels too far away? And actually, to me, a more terrifying question is, what happens when God feels too close? On a certain level, much of the Chumash, if you go through the Bible, in fact, much of the panorama of Jewish time can be reduced to one dynamic. Either God hides and withdraws, or we do. What this attests to is the remarkable difficulty in finding a balance between us and God, being able to feel God's presence and yet feel myself. Because in the beginning, of course, we know there was contraction. Right? Lurianic Kabbalah teaches us that God contracts a process known as Tzimtzum in order to make space for the world, in order for us to exist. God must, so to speak, hide himself if we are to be. And after the creation of the first human being, God's first instruction also begins to toy with the notion of a shared space, of giving people room by getting himself out of the way. The Pasuk tells us, Mikol Eitz Hagan Ochal Tochel, of every tree of the garden you may surely eat. So God tells Adam, it's all yours, no restrictions. I make space for you and your desires, save for one thing, the Eitz Hadat. But Adam cannot abide that limitation on his autonomy. He needs God to withdraw further. Now that you've gotten yourself out of the way a bit, I need you to get all the way out of the way. Completely out of the way. And then I can exist. See, because humans have always struggled with the contradiction of desperately yearning for God's presence and doing anything possible to banish that presence. As it was in Eden, so it is with us. The result of Adam and Chava's inability to live within their allotted space, enormous irony, is that now they begin to withdraw even from their permitted space. They hide. Vayitchabe Adam v'ishto mibnei Hashem Elokim b'toch Eitz Hagan. Right? The man and his wife begin to hide from God in the garden. Now it's our turn to contract. The tzimtzum of Adam and Chava in the garden is not mystical, it's psychological. It's the tzimtzum of shame. So we repay God's attempt to give us freedom by running away as far as possible from that connection, and we hide. So what's the significance of the tree? It's the question of life boundaries. Can we accept that there are places that we should not venture to? That there are things we should not listen to? That there are events that we dare not watch? That there are relationships that we must not continue? That there are objects that do not belong to us? There are desires that we should not act on? Can we learn to live in our space, in our skin? The test of the garden is the test of that balance. And it's a very difficult, painful process for both God and us, although I can only speak for the latter. As anyone living in this century instinctively understands, the possibility of God hiding is very dangerous. In the wake of that hiding is the sense of human morality lost altogether. The great contemporary Talmudic scholar, Rabbi Dr. David Weiss Halivni, in his book, Breaking the Tablets, wrestles with the notion of tzimtzum as a way of working through the Holocaust. The context of that, he begins by arguing adamantly that he refuses to accept the thesis that Jewish sin provoked God's punishment. In the Shoah, as you know, if you've read Weiss Halivni's work, he was taken prisoner by the Nazis and sent to the camps. In his words, God must, on rare occasions, when it seems like God is occupying too much cosmic space, I don't know what that means, must regenerate the tzimtzum by revacating the world. Somehow God feels, I have to split. I have to get out of here. But when that does occur, the moral challenge for people is enormous, because if we're left to our own devices, we face the task of choosing either good and evil, presumably completely free from divine restraints. It reminds one, if you've read The Brothers Karamazov, of the mindset of Ivan Karamazov, who basically, you know, if there's no God, everything is permissible. That's basically his point of view. So what I'm arguing here, actually, is that there is a direct line from Gan Eden to Auschwitz. Straight line, unbroken. A direct line between the freedom to breach the boundary of the tree and the inability for contemporary humanity to exercise the right moral choices in the face of God's apparent absence. And again and again and again, the Torah is stressing this delicacy of the balance and the great perplexity that we feel if God is not exactly where we want him. Not too close, not too far away. My wife Leah has often discussed, and she's taught me, about a certain feature of the Haggadah, which comes up in the ritual of Yachatz, which entails another example of hiding. This time the hiding of the Afikoman. In his commentary on this section of Yachatz, and you know what happens, you break the middle matzah, and part of it gets put away. The Israeli scholar Mark Elan Waknin points out that through the ritual of hiding the Afikoman, it seems like it's just a playful diversion for children, but it has actually much deeper resonances psychologically and metaphysically. Professor Waknin notes that Freud, in his book Beyond the Pleasure Principle, describes the play of his young son, who is a year and a half old. He would take a reel attached to a cord, then he would make it disappear and reappear. Make it hide and come back, is another way of putting it. And that's what little kids do. If you watch infants and toddlers, right? We've all seen our children do this when they were little with balls or dolls or small objects. They hide them, and then they make them reappear. And they love that game. And that game, Freud called Fort Da, which in German is sort of away and here, or there and here. And it represents the child's attempt to symbolically master absence, specifically the absence and reappearance of the mother. It's a scary thing, right? You're tiny, and your world, your mom is here, and then she's gone, and it's terrifying. And so the child, amazingly, right, works out this process of mastering their anxiety about this by playing this game of Fort Da, where they see that something that leaves, that's gone, that's hidden, that's disappeared, can come back. So the anguish at seeing the mother leave is overcome by the certitude of seeing her reappear, just as he knows through the repetitive power of the game that he'll be able to bring the object back by pulling on that cord. I sort of think that's what Jewish life is. It's the struggle to pull on that cord and the fear of the object actually reappearing. The Israelites cannot conquer their visceral fear of Moshe's absence when he goes up on Sinai and gets the Torah. From the perspective of Bnei Yisrael, Moshe's gone into hiding, and that's intolerable. So they construct the calf. And here, they're like a little boy. They need to lure in the real once more by building a substitute. This is their way of throwing a rope up to Moshe and bringing him back. They make a kind of fake Moshe. So what does Moshe do next? And here I think Professor Waknin argues brilliantly. He comes down the mountain. He sees what the Jewish people have done. He breaks the luchot. Why does he do this? He lets the object slip out of his hands as if to tell the Jews, objects are not the point. The luchot, the calf, even I, Moshe, were not the point. I'm breaking the luchot to try and liberate you from the need to keep pulling at that cord. To teach you that something that's absent is not necessarily gone. So can we learn to tolerate the space that God provides for us, even if God is not there all the time? Can we attain what the child psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott called object permanence? The ability to hold on to a vision of someone or something and by extension God, without the actual physical presence of that entity. If you think of Christianity in this regard, it's actually very interesting. Right, the temptation, Christianity is one giant pull at the cord. Right, the temptation of turning God into a human of flesh and blood, the intolerableness of the invisible, now comes back permanently ensconced in something that you can see and touch and, of course, that you can crucify. So it's a very stubborn paradox. We don't know how to be without structural and ritual and objects, and we call that religion. And we add heaps and heaps of minutiae, hoping to reel in God once more. On the other hand, once we get all that stuff, we really don't know how to live with it. We don't know how to live lives of restriction, boundaried by a finite lifespan, we're mortal, and by a set of claims on our autonomy. The same set of dynamics, the exact same, pertains to the destruction of the Second Temple. The well-known Gemara in Brachot, on Daf Chet Amud Aleph, Miyom Shecharav Beit HaMikdash, Ein Lo LaKadosh Baruch Hu Be'olamo Ela Arba Amot Shel Halacha Bilvad. Since the day that the temple was destroyed, the Holy One, blessed be He, has nothing in this world but the four cubits of halacha. I want you to think about that metaphor for just a sec. So not only are the consequences of the Roman destruction felt on earth, but also in the upper realms, something is achieved by the Churban that's, of course, philosophically impossible. God becomes restricted in space. God hides inside of halacha. God not only confines himself to the narrow confines of four cubits, but also removes himself from every other human activity. Only where halacha can be studied can God be found. The implications of this are rather sobering, and the theology is certainly remarkable. Instead of a divine presence imbuing the whole world, God enters a ghetto. True, it's a ghetto of halacha, but it's a ghetto nonetheless. And the Jewish people, if they're to follow suit, to imitate God's ways, must enter a severely constricted mindset. When law and legalism becomes the only benchmarks of the spiritual life, with a concomitant alienation from everything else. So as a consequence of Sinat Chinam, God allows the temple to be destroyed, and as a result of this act, in a sense God's own act, God must enter exile and suffer the same fate as the Jewish people. So in order for us to have contact with God, we certainly must take up a four-cubit space. If you want to do the math, it's about 180 centimeters. And remain focused solely on the law. It's as if to say that should you want to meet God elsewhere, outside of the law, to be, as it were, an outlaw, that's where the word comes from, you'll find nobody home. Halakha can be restorative, but the price is that all their pursuits have to be secondary or sidelined. And I think that's what Rav Amital was getting at in the quote that I read previously. So at times the game feels sort of zero sum. If there's more of us, there must be, by definition, less God available. If we want to grow up, God must contract. When the temple is destroyed and we lose our space, our sacred space, and we become diminished, God responds in kind by contracting a second time, by joining us now only in halachic space. So he contracted to create the world. Things went wrong again. He contracts further, and now he's inside of four cubits of halacha. So the pattern here is that in order for us to sustain ourselves, God keeps getting smaller and smaller still. The fear must be that at a certain point, God will contract so much that he'll virtually disappear altogether. And what's the meaning of such a disappearance? That's, to me, the post-Holocaust dilemma. The contraction after the contraction after the contraction. The argument which I've tried to trace here is that God contracts first out of necessity to create a world, then perhaps out of empathy as a response to the Churban HaBayit, and is continually trying to rebalance and refine the relationship between himself and the world, now intervening, now withdrawing, to allow for human freedom. But I'm not actually a fan of neat hypotheses, and one of the reasons is that human life is not a thesis. I don't believe that the toddlers on the way to the gas chambers or the open pits would have been comforted by a Tzimtzum thesis. Well, nor am I. Here's the testimony of a prisoner in Auschwitz in the summer of 1944 at the peak of the killing. When the Hungarian Jews arrived, we used a music camouflage. At the time, the children were burned on big piles of wood. The crematoria could not work at the time. Therefore, the people were just burned in open fields with those grills, and children were burned alongside with them. Children were crying helplessly. That's why the camp administration ordered that an orchestra be made by 100 inmates, and they should play the Blue Danube, or Rosamund, which is a piece by Schubert, so that even the people in the city of Auschwitz could not hear the screams. Without the orchestra, they would have heard the screams of horror. And then, on one special day, they started burning them to death. The gas chambers at the time were out of order. At least one of them was out of order, namely the one near the crematorium. It was destroyed by a mutiny in a Sonderkommando in August 1944, which left three gas chambers left. They were filled with adults. Therefore, the children were not gassed, but burned alive. When one of the SS people sort of had pity on the children, he took the child and beat the head against a stone first before putting on the pile of fire and wood so that the child lost consciousness. However, the regular way they did it was just by throwing the children onto the pile. They used to put a sheet of wood, then the whole thing was sprinkled with gasoline, then wood again, then gasoline, then wood, then people. Thereafter, the whole pile was lit. Here, the doctrine of divine contraction is, if I might put it, up against the doctrine of gasoline and wood. The conversion of humanity into matchsticks. For my money, philosophical and mystical ideas have to survive that funeral pyre, must be able to withstand that smoke and burning of flesh. Otherwise, what do you have? God withdraws so humanity can grow up. God withdraws so children can burn up. Because there is a very big difference between contracting and abandoning, between divine self-limitation and divine disappearance altogether, which is why I'm not a fan of neat theories. For Avraham Yehoshua Heschel, and he wrote about this his whole life, the divine self-limiting is not voluntary. The exile is caused by us, by human action, and interestingly, human non-action. It's not just what we do, it's actually more what we don't do. Heschel writes, the divine will is the will to be here, manifest and nearby. I hope Heschel's right. But when the doors of the world are suddenly slammed shut on him, his truth is betrayed and his will challenged, he withdraws, leaving man with himself. God did not withdraw of his own will. God was expelled. God is living in exile. So for Heschel, it's Adam's hiding in the garden that initiates this pattern of human history. We're hiders. Heschel says it is man who hides, who flees, who has an alibi, who has all sorts of reasons for escaping. I don't know if Heschel is correct. I do not know if we provoke God's absence to such an extent that great forces of evil would then be unleashed on us. But I suspect that God does not require my defense or my rationalizations on his behalf. What God needs for me to do is to stop hiding. And I actually see that as the key spiritual task of the age. And I've thought about this a lot. I've thought about all the Torah I learn and all the mitzvot, paltry as they are, that I do. But I've come to the conclusion that what God really needs is for me to stop hiding. And I speak with authority, since I'm a hider par excellence. What does it mean to hide? And why would that be a key spiritual question? I will leave that for the moment. I also believe that Jewish communities have hidden themselves throughout history and certainly after the Shoah. It was a strategy of self-restriction and limitation. It was a successful survival strategy in Jewish history. You didn't want to venture too far out into the marketplace of non-Jewish hegemony. It was risky. It was unpredictable. But it's a strategy that now haunts us as our self-restrictions and our voluntary exiles from the world and its richness in the guise of survival or continuity has proved not only crippling, but it also prolongs God's exile as well. I know this is counterintuitive. We hear many stories today about all the people learning Torah and the many yeshivot and the flourishing of day schools and synagogues. There's, of course, the remarkable rebirth of the State of Israel. There are Jews in all sorts of prominent positions. I don't need to rehearse this. Everyone is aware of this self-congratulatory narrative. It's, of course, also true that assimilation and intermarriage continually virtually unabated for years now. And I hear this all the time because I'm in Jewish education. Jewish communities around the world, in the wake of the spate of statistics that we spit out, warning of massive assimilation and intermarriage among younger Jews, have become obsessed with Jewish continuity, the survival of the Jewish people. And I, too, used to worry about continuity, to ponder what will become of the Jewish people given the unstoppable trend, it seems, of modernity towards autonomy, making my own choices, being free, being secular. Mea culpa, I've come to the conclusion that I've been on the wrong track. I believe anxieties about the future of the Jewish people, though understandable, actually take us into the wrong direction. And it is not that this all this statistical foreboding is insignificant. It's real. It's true. It's simply that I no longer view that as the real heart of the matter. The question is not continuity, it's purpose. Why do we sit on the floor and lament? So after we marry our Jewish spouse, then what? And after Birthright, and after March of the Living, and after Kiruv organizations and Jewish day schools and Havdalah at camp ceremonies, then what? And after we mumble our prayers and check our lettuce for bugs and make sure our shmura matzah is of the highest quality, then what? I don't mean to denigrate these things. They are mitzvot, and as such they deserve our attention and our care. But larger questions need to take precedence at this point. What are we doing with Torah? For what reason are we born? And what's left of our time? During the 60s, in his response to the Vietnam War, and he said this over and over again in different versions, Rabbi Heschel said this, "Morally speaking, there is no limit to the concern one must feel for the suffering of human beings. It has also become clear to me that in regard to cruelties committed in the name of a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible." In light of Heschel's call for social justice and human concern, it is quite sobering to consider a statement that was made by Professor Moshe Sokolow about graduates of Orthodox Jewish day schools. Though such day schools have been successful in teaching text and instilling within the students the centrality of mitzvot, the ethos of social awareness and a universalistic outlook is much less present. This is what he argues. He says, what are the students of our day schools contributing towards eradicating the evils of slavery, poverty, war, racism, sexism, inequality, and hunger that regularly plague our planet, inhabited as it happens to be by creatures created in Tzelem Elohim, the image of God, fundamentally no different from our own? And if they do not actively search for a cure for these ills, do they at least bemoan them? We have used Torah not to inhabit space, but to hide. Not to create connections with the four corners of God's world, but often it would seem to perpetuate a status quo of comfort and stasis. And I do not believe that it was meant to be this way. The situation starts when we are young. It begins with our children, in our attitudes towards educating them, and our hope and vision for their future. What is it that we really wish for them? A month ago, I was in England teaching, and at a Shabbat table, I heard a man launch into a polemic against Jewish education. That's a professional hazard. As soon as somebody finds out I'm a professor of education, I know that a rant is going to begin. The teachers are no good, the principals are no good, etc. The man was clearly proud of his son, who was next to him at the Shabbat table. His son is graduating high school. Son is a bright young man, plans to go to yeshiva and then go to medical schools, got it all sort of plotted out. I listened to this for some minutes with no interruption. When he was finished, I only asked him one thing. I said, what would you do if your son came home one day and said he decided to forgo medicine because he wanted to go into Jewish education? After all, he seems exceedingly bright and talented. He could help correct the situation. You would have thought that I would have said he was going to enter a life of crime. Absolutely appalling. And, you know, I talked before about gut-level reactions that you really don't control. Gut-level reaction. 3 seconds after I asked it, oh, no, he said, just like that. Oh, no. No, said the man, not at all. Making me, the Jewish educator, feel somewhat like a leper, but I moved on from there. Change starts when we are able to make the connection between what we feel is wrong and what we're doing to contribute to rectifying that issue. Because complaining doesn't do anything. Complaining doesn't fix anything. It's good to sit on the floor. It's good to utter keynote, even though I suspect most people haven't a clue what they're uttering. But figuring out how we can make a difference to the next generation seems just as pressing a task to me. And we also have to reconcile ourselves to the fact that redemption is long and it's slow, and the choices we make will not result in an instantly changed world. We may not even see the results for a long time. A few months ago, my wife introduced me to the work of Dr. James Orbinski. On July 3rd, 1994, on one of the final days of the Rwandan genocide, in a hospital in Kigali, Dr. Orbinski was amputating the leg of a 14-year-old boy who had stepped on a landmine. The boy's foot was hanging by a thread. Dr. Orbinski, who is Canadian, was 33 years old at the time, and he had performed numerous amputations in Rwanda. He had treated the most brutal, horrifying kinds of injuries you can imagine, but this was the first procedure that he had performed unaccompanied by any other physician. That's just how it happened to be that day. And he was afraid. He was afraid that he might cut a vital artery and kill the child. Worse yet, there were no instruments available. All the hospital's surgical blades were broken. The only available tool was a hacksaw. Dr. Orbinski shaved off the boy's leg above the knee, and then he stitched it, and he shaped the tissue, and the boy's leg was gone, but the boy was alive. It was, says Orbinski, an imperfect offering, which is the title of his book. All we have are imperfect offerings with imperfect outcomes. But that does not alleviate the need to try and implement change individually, communally, globally. It is absolutely ideal that the boy survived. It is far from ideal that he is without a leg. The story of how Orbinski, who is not Jewish, went into humanitarian work is important, and I commend you to listen. At the age of 9, living in Montreal, he saw a television program on the Holocaust with images of bodies, flesh, and arms with tattooed numbers. The next day, his mother took him to the Jewish section of the city to buy him new shoes. A very kind old man, who he said had bright eyes and kept saying to him, "You're a good boy," and who he found incredibly nurturing, helped him buy the shoes, and he noticed numbers on the man's arm. That night, he had a nightmare about himself and all of his family members, as well as the old shoemaker, taking off their new shoes and giving them to the Nazis. As Orbinski grew older, he knew that what he wanted to do was to help alleviate the suffering of others, and he reached that decision at 9. Now, Orbinsky speaks of something he calls living your question, which he defines as entering into what really draws you into life, what calls you. That is to live your question. What can you do with what you know? What can you really do with the gifts you have? I'm not talking about your vocation or what we might do to make money or what we might do to keep ourselves alive. What do we do to live our question? And everybody has a question that they've been carrying their whole life about what life means to them and what perplexes them. We teach young people many interesting things, but do we teach them to live their question, to even know what the question of their lives might be? We cannot hide in the corner of the garden. We must model to our children what it is to really live out our questions and teach them not to be afraid of theirs. This would mean to ultimately be able to focus on the inherent and unique value of each child in ways that avoid the pitfalls of mass-produced education. I'm going to conclude with one other idea. One of the best examples of this phenomenon in 20th century Jewry comes from a most unlikely source. In the city of Warsaw, in 1877, a Jew was born who was named Henryk Goldschmidt. He grew up in an assimilated Jewish family and became a doctor. And by the age of 21, he was writing fiction under the pseudonym of Janusz Korczak. Korczak was both a physician and an author, but he was best known for his utter dedication to caring for children, particularly orphans. He was the director of a Jewish orphanage in Warsaw, and when World War II broke out, the orphanage was moved inside of the Warsaw ghetto. Korczak received multiple offers to leave the ghetto, to be hidden as a non-Jew on the other side of Warsaw, and he refused each time. He was unwilling to abandon his children. On August 5, 1942, the Nazis rounded up Korczak and his approximately 200 orphans, and they were herded off to Treblinka. Even at the last minute, he was offered sanctuary. According to one report, he had to persuade the Nazis to allow him to go with the children. An eyewitness describes the procession of Korczak that day. A miracle occurred. 200 children did not cry out. 200 pure souls condemned to death did not weep. Not one of them ran away. None tried to hide. They clung to their teacher and mentor, to their father and brother, Janusz Korczak, so that he might protect and preserve them. Korczak was marching, his head bent forward, holding the hand of a child without a hat, a leather belt around his waist, wearing high boots. The very stones of the street wept at the sight of the procession. Korczak, along with his 200 children, were murdered in Treblinka. This sketch of a life cannot even begin to reveal Korczak's profound understanding of children and how they should be taught. And you should know that around the world today in education, people are studying Korczak's theories and discussing the future of his ideas for education. Because Korczak wanted education to be based on the idea that children were the breeding ground for the future of society. And as such, democracy wasn't just something you learned about, it was something you practiced. His orphaned and impoverished children were offered the opportunity not just to learn in school, but to create the school. From an early age in his school, the children were invited to set up codes of conduct for themselves, a court of peers, and what was called a children's parliament. Students were handed significant responsibility for themselves, including assessing punishments for their own misbehavior. For Korczak, creating a school community where each child felt empowered to make a difference in the life of a school, where children were not just kids, but they were citizens. As Professor Liba Engel writes, this would attune children to matters of social justice and cooperative decision-making, creating a miniature embryonic democracy. Korczak treated children as rational agents who needed to participate in matters that, after all, concern them. It's their school. Each child mattered. Korchak is amazing. Had detailed notes on every kid, every single child. He had detailed notes on their physical, emotional, cognitive, and psychological development alone. And he was not naive. There were children there, obviously, who were traumatized, who were angry, who were sad. But he trusted that each one of them could make a contribution. And much of his work focused on the ways in which children could learn to engage in respectful and caring relationships through self-rule and self-responsibility. He writes what I think is a fascinating thing. I believe that many children rebel against virtue because they have been incessantly trained and overfed in its vocabulary. Let the child discover for himself slowly the need for altruism, its beauty and sweetness. Korchak had certain basic questions about children. Number one, who is this child? Number two, what are their gifts? Number three, what do they fear? Number four, how can I make them feel valued? Those are the educational questions. The rest is secondary. In his book, How to Love a Child, begins with this sentence. You say dealing with children is tiresome. You're right. You say because we need to always kneel to their perceptions, to stoop, to bend. You're wrong. Because actually we have to reach up to their feelings, to stand on tippy toe to their perceptions and ideals. And that is what is tiring. I have seen the principles of Korchak's philosophy in a real life setting, in the Reut school in Yerushalayim. It's remarkable to behold. It's like no other school I've ever seen. The kids actually have a direct voice in how the school works. They learn how to be citizens. Korchak's conception is not just about coercion or obedience, or conversely about pandering and spoiling. It's about being a guardian of the world. This is not simply a philosophy of education. It's the very center of Torah. It's how it was meant to be at the beginning. In Eden, we are told to be shomrim, to guard the garden. Instead, we end up hiding. Then God begins to hide and the whole cycle continues. When we confront things that need changing, we're often overwhelmed by what seems to be the large hill we must climb and the obstacles in our way. But it is possible to create change by focusing on one moment at a time, one child at a time. It is also possible for each person to be responsible. Whether it's your shul, or your school, or your relationship, or your soul. Because the alternative, to be frank, is to sit back passively, or to complain, or to remain silent, and then feel regret and ruefulness years later. Why didn't I do something? All we have are imperfect offerings. Finally, at the end of his stunning novel, On Chesil Beach, the British author Ian McEwan comments on the failure of his main character to speak in a single moment to the woman he loves at a point of crisis in their relationship. He simply watches her run away and spends many years after living a kind of flat existence. McEwan notes with a poignant irony, quote, "This is how the entire course of a life can be changed, by doing nothing." We don't just change the world by the things we do. We change it by the things we omit, by the sentences we fail to say, by the actions we think of, but just somehow cannot commit. I hope that when we stop hiding from our emotional truths, hiding from asking the difficult questions about Judaism and faith, and searching for real as opposed to canned formulaic answers, hiding from doubt, hiding from poverty that is around us, hiding from the things we fear and hiding from the people we love, hiding from silence by continuously talking, and hiding from life by substituting the golden calf of distraction, that perhaps when we finish hiding, God can feel safe enough to stop hiding from us. This very imperfect talk is in the memory of my father, Konimus Kalman ben Nachum Halevi, Bechasya, who was Niftar this past year on Vav Kislev. My father's father was murdered by the Nazis. My father's world was torn apart. May his memory and the memory of all those who perished and continue to sacrifice al Kiddush Hashem be for a blessing.